Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate. Now listen to this, I'll tell you about heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopeless night, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
The summertime song. Apple. Lord, there goes the beautiful 49, like sheep of the angels riding, riding down the line. We think there is a soul.
A dilapidated version of Summertime as I stumble on the air here again. Can we get this eclipse off my somatic awareness tonight? My God, I've had enough. What the people are saying? Oh, man, there's so much to talk about, my friends. So much. Unbelievable. You know?
Let the goat killing all the bees.
Hey! There you go. All right. Get that out of the way. Get life on the road here. My God. Just sat through the Obama speech between the Mets grinding my intestines into a flat line as they... losing again to the Nationals tonight, 3-1 here in the eighth inning, as the season is ending early this year. Apparently, they're going to fade to black before the football camps open. The way this is going, I can't even imagine if I went through everything I had to talk about tonight to cover it all. I mean, I'll just give you a little skinny. Bing. Oh, there's last week's guest tweeting during the show. Enjoying a nearly authentic Greek salad. Why do you have to tell us that? That's last week's guest, John Murray, who is apparently going to a Twitter recovery group soon. My Mets, just to give you a little insight on what's been going on, the assistant general manager, who is the vice president of operations, who oversees all the minor leagues, name's Tony Bernizard, and he's a flaming ontosapien. Now, you can learn about what that is at somerspace.org. That's not here nor there. This is what this guy did. Now, there's been almost on a daily basis, there's been some report of what this guy does behind the scenes to make life miserable for everybody around him. This takes the cake, though. He goes up to the Binghamton Mets, which is their AA affiliate up the road here, right? And they are a struggling little franchise. They're about 25 games under 500. So, right before the All-Star break, he's there, and, you know, there's some young kids in the team that are below the age of 21, but they're enjoying a libation in the locker room after the game. They're not playing very well. Well, here comes Big Tony. He decides he's going to make a big power speech and takes off his freaking shirt and challenges these kids to fight him. This is what he does. Now, if any of us did that in our job... the parent organization wouldn't have an investigatory interlude to decide how to deal with that. That would be one incident. But this guy's had about 20. He yelled at a scout and berated a little intern. Again, you're tweeting? It's just too much. And yet he still has a job. So there's a lot of anger in the world. You know, and when I see these things happening, if we knew how to profile, if we all joined hands together and knew the Soma, you know, maybe there'd be some ability to kind of steer clear of this stuff. Maybe not give a guy like that much power. You know, maybe that'd be too much. as Murphy hits here with two out and two on in the eighth inning. I'm keeping an eye on that. But back to Obama, who spent the better part of 40 minutes completely blathering. And now this is an exo-sapien. Again, go to summerspace.org to learn what an exo is. I'm not going to do it every damn week. Getting grouchy. But basically a 9%er, as the planets go, in terms of brain design. And he is excellent at the fibbing and lying and doing all kinds of crazy things. And the Mets are out in the eighth as Murphy skies to left. And they go to the ninth, down 3-1, after getting two on and one out. They got a foul pop and a little bloop to left. Amazing. Oh, my liver. Hang on a second. I got to play this. That's it.
I got a bad liver and a broken heart.
There you go. So Obama rambled on and basically is going to toss everything at this health care bill that he possibly can. Hook or crook, he's going to jam it down our throats. And if it doesn't go down our throats, he'll find another orifice to jam it up. But it's going through, baby, because this country needs what he has to offer us. Whether we want it or not, whether we can afford it or not, whether it makes sense or not. What is health anymore, really? We can't seem to do it. We have a Center for Disease Control, and then we have a health care bill. I think they're one and the same. They're both trying to deal with inevitabilities in a very kind of a poor framework. And maybe our guests can get into that a little bit, because on the spiritual side, we had an eclipse today that was very interesting in the way that the world dealt with this. I don't know if you follow this much, but this is what happened. Okay, now if you missed it, it was mostly in, of course, seen and felt in Asia. Longest eclipse since 91, lasted about 6 minutes and 53 seconds. It was visible from Hawaii to South America, and there won't be a longer one until 2132. Now that's a long time. So this is a big deal. Okay, now, in China, fireworks and danced in Shanghai, right? They're having a good time. On a remote Japanese island, bewildered cattle went into their feeding troughs thinking night had fallen. And in India, a woman was crushed as thousands of viewers crowded the banks of the Ganges for a glimpse. So a woman got killed because people were looking at an eclipse. Millions of Asians were watching this today. Millions of others, fearing a bad omen, shuttered themselves indoors, right? Now, yesterday was the new moon. Today you have a solar eclipse. This is like basically the universe saying, control, alt, delete, and rebooting. It's a very strange event, all right? So thousands of Hindus took to the waters to cleanse their sins. They only got 3 minutes and 48 seconds of the eclipse. The gathering was marred when a 65 woman was killed and 6 people injured in a stampede. Oh, boy. Unbelievable. This is the world we're living in here. Sky turned dark, like in the dead of night, and the air turned cooler, and the cicadas, the little crickets, stopped singing, so it gets a little funky. Jubilant eclipse watchers in China had a party. The other guys are running in the river killing each other. Yeah. In Beijing, a thick blanket of grayish smog blocked out the sky, and it rained a little bit. Total eclipses, of course, when the moon moves directly between the sun and the earth, covering completely the cast of shadow. Now, can you imagine for eons thinking, you know, the earth is the center of the universe, what happened when these kinds of things went down? And these superstitions and basically these traditions are still very much alive all over the world. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, these countries are getting more worldly and more interactive, and the value systems are getting laid on top of each other. But in a Buddhist temple, you got the monks having a mass prayer. You got a prominent astrologer in India saying the eclipse is a bad omen for the country. You got people selling green umbrellas and wearing special glasses because they're going to celebrate it. You know, who knows? It's amazing. All this because the moon got between the sun and the earth. So it's hard to figure out. But anyway, we now have some help because our guests are on the line here. So joining us on the hotline here as I get the siren going. Samuel and Linda Bonder from California, I guess. Is that where you guys are tonight?
That's correct. Yeah. Sonoma, California.
Hi, Mark.
Okay. Hi, welcome to Soma Time. And we're just talking about the different ways people were experiencing the eclipse today.
Mm-hmm.
And how the Western and not-so-Western worldviews were being bandied about, sometimes within the same country. The superstitions and the science superstitions that were around about that. So why don't we start there? When things happen that are a little bit celestial in nature, when you have these kinds of things, these kinds of events, you know, we've had any number of them the last couple of years that I can remember people going crazy about. From your vantage point, being able to sort of have a foot in both worlds, as it were, do you view it more as opportunity for these different cultures to sort of blend, or do you view it more as like them with the most integrity is going to carry on and them with no more use for the world is going to fade out? Like, do you see these older worldviews being more persistent and having some staying power, having some truth within them, or do you think that as a community that humanity is starting to embrace more of the modern traditions?
Well, personally, first of all, Mark, I'd like to just say hi and thanks for having us on your show.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's a combination of both. I think the ancient traditions will always be around. You know, this is fundamental to human life in many cultures. But I do believe as well that there are many, many people who are shaping and shifting their viewpoints and their religious belief systems and their spiritual seeking processes into different directions. And so it's a combination. And some of it just comes right down to the mystery of being human as well.
Yeah, and again, I mean, like I was just saying, you've got people that are looking at it as a celebration in China.
Yeah.
And people that looked at it as a spiritual threat in India, and they were running into the Ganges River, and they killed a woman, stampeding her. So,
Yeah,
people do a lot of things in the name of their belief system. That's why we have a little tagline on the show, is to go beyond the BS, beyond the belief system,
mm-hmm.
and get to experience truth that you can actually share. And so, you know, I get into some of these nuances, especially when you have a current event like this. And then when you look at that and bounce it off of, you know, what's going on in this country. You know, we just had Obama talking for an hour about the future of healthcare, and
yeah.
In the entire time he spoke, he never really defined what health was. I don't know what we're taking care of.
That's interesting.
So I looked at it as just another rodeo that had no horses and a lot of rope. So you guys again. I was saying before, we have a Center for Disease Control, and now we have a healthcare plan and a bill, and it seems as if they're the same thing. They're just a bunch of words to describe human experiences from different directions without really any sense of wholeness about it. And unfortunately, people's lives get altered by that. And I like to talk about vitality because that's something I know what it is, and that's why. When I see him talking like that, and he went off about, I don't know, 40, 45 minutes before he started taking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody asked him what health was, which to me would be like, you know, like basically like before you even started to put a plan down, you might want to define this thing in terms that would cover all the bases, but they're not really capable of it. We've had some other people on the show last month or so trying to speak about what wellness is, and it's another nebulous concept. Now you guys deal with a greater intangible, which would be spirituality, and how that evolves, and how someone can go from having basically no spiritual awareness no spiritual conscious awareness. They might have religious practices, they might have some of these value systems, but they don't really see themselves in a spiritual light. They see themselves as a physical person living a life that has emotions and things like that. And, oh, yeah, okay, once a week I go into this room and everyone sings and then I go home. But you guys are dealing with it in a much more fundamental way. And I guess to start with, you guys begin with this capitalizing this word heart in your practice of heart gazing. So let's get into what heart is when you capitalize this. It, again, you're dealing with both the secular and the spiritual sort of connotations of that term.
Well, yeah, thank you, Mark. And just to respond very briefly, I think we tend to take the long view that humanity is gradually making some advances, but there's always a lot of steps backward happening or evidence that not much change has happened in lots of areas. So the more of us who can get into this kind of conversation and life-changing that you're obviously committed to with the no belief system or beyond belief system kind of approach, we greatly appreciate that. What we mean by heart, and the reason we capitalize it is because it's a way of pointing to the essence of what it is to be alive as human beings that is intrinsically also divine, and that encompasses both our spiritual nature and our material nature, and really draws upon, hopefully, the best of both traditional understanding and newly emergent understanding in both the scientific and the spiritual dimensions. So it's a very integrated and holistic word, and we capitalize it because when people hear the word or see the word heart in spiritual terms, they tend to think of very important values like love and compassion, and there's more to it than that. There is really the root of our identity and our connection to the universe and to the mystery that's really unnameable.
Again, this is something that's, I guess, maybe in the last 10 years, because, you know, the 90s being the decade of the brain, there was also, in a parallel way, there was also a decade of the soul. Everyone started talking about the soul, Thomas More's books, and there's just a million books came out because we started getting into the quantum paradigm and transcendence, and Deepak's books were coming out. Everybody was getting into these, you know, very abstract versions of, well, sort of, I guess, Tao physics, things like that. We were trying to get this bridge going between the physical universe that we're in and this metaphysical universe that sort of contains that. And there was any number of new priests that came up, and they all looked like physicists to me. They all looked like scientists to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were making it extremely precise. I mean, we're going to touch on Ken Wilber's work in a minute here as one of the guys that came as a guy, you know, to build some ways to kind of translate or at least make those two realms a little more simpatico, where they weren't completely, 90 degrees from each other, and you couldn't get, you know, the two worlds to communicate. A lot of the stuff that popped up in even in research with the brain, dealing with just simple things like people having out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences or dealing with memory or dream recall or stuff that, you know, the average Joe Sixpack isn't going to go, oh, my God, there they go again, you know, talking about angels on the head of a pin or something like that. So as we've gotten more sophisticated in the terminology and gotten more scientific in the way we go, oh, it's this part of the brain and temporal lobe, and look at the fMRI of this person who's meditating, and we took these monks and we put them in a room and they were able to heal a piece of DNA, you know, 6 miles away or whatever it is. All these experiments, and you've seen, you know, you guys have seen the movies the last 3 or 4 years, like the Bleep movie and some of Lynn McTaggart's work with the field and all the quantum things and the quantum cornflakes that are out there. Everything's quantum now. I found another one the other day where the guy's doing neurological rehabilitation, but it has to be quantum neurology. It's like you could put that on a gas station and people are going to line up. are people more attracted to the buzzwords from science to give it to authenticate things, or are they more interested in the spiritual sort of pudding and the payoff of having the ability to sort of liberate themselves from that linear world that you know, traditional mainstream science doesn't really talk much about this stuff. In fact, they act as if it doesn't exist. It's all just a bunch of superstition to them. So I always find it interesting how it seems like the metaphysical community will sort of co-opt or they'll kidnap, in some cases, you know, some of these scientists and stick them in a room and point a camera at them and say, talk about the physics of the soul. And it's like when you say heart, now that's something that has a lot of different meanings from a lot of different vantage points. And it's sort of, in a way, it sort of disarms a lot of the argument because everyone else is focusing on the brain, which gets into the cold neurology. And you guys are dealing with emotion, and you're dealing with feeling, and you're dealing with history and memory, and the heart being the center, sort of the sun in the equation, and you know, the brain being more kind of moon-like in a way, kind of just, you know, like it's this lump in our head that seems to think different things, but we don't really have that same kind of soft, fuzzy relationship with our brains as we do with our hearts. Mm. So when you guys are communicating a spiritual message that is complex and does have a lot of, you know, nuances to it, do you find, you've been doing this for a while, do you find that the audiences are more interested in simplifying this and getting back to the basics of it, or do they want the complex explanations? I guess Linda can take that one.
Yeah, well, I think, again, there's several people who are totally into the scientific explanations, the understanding of the brain function, what actually does the heart do? What's the function of the heart? But there's so much mystery to it as well. There is the actual real function of the brain and the heart. The sinoatrial node is the location in the heart on the right side, upper right side of the heart, that is supposedly, according to reports and even a scientific discovery, the seat of consciousness, where consciousness actually comes from, where it is enlivened in the body itself. Mm-hmm. Some people have very strong feeling senses of the sinoatrial node energetically and intuitively. Mm-hmm. Others don't. And so here's the mystery. They'll hear teachings about it, and some people will say, wow, well, I understand it logically, but I don't quite feel it. One of the things that Samuel and I do in the work that we do with heart gazing and the other offerings that we do around the world is we help individuals access, as you mentioned, Mark, the actual feelings and emotions linked behind the thinking process. Quite often when I'm working with someone, I'll say, okay, so you've got a logical understanding of what something could be or how it actually operates, but how is the body relating to that? How is it really hitting you emotionally and energetically? So you have that piece of the heart and the sinoatrial node and just the form itself, the understanding of the physiology of who we are as human beings. Then I want to address the paradox of existence, which it is a mystery. It's the both and. It's the piece that is inexplicable. It's unresolvable. So Samuel, I'm sure, can say a bit more about that. But the paradox of existence is not about logic and scientific understanding, and I think that's why some of the scientific studies have a hard time with figuring it out, because you can't figure it out on some deep spiritual level. Samuel, you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, first of all, some people have a hunger for just a very simple explanation and something more experiential, maybe more emotional, and other people really have a passion for the complexity and the nuances, not only of much more of a detailed explanation, whether spiritual or scientific in nature, but also more nuances of in-depth understanding of themselves. And I think that's, you know, again, it's human nature. That's how people are. And, yeah, we try to, as best we can, respond to both kinds of needs and to help people from whichever direction they're coming grow to include what they're tending to leave out as well. And that includes everything Linda was talking about there.
Yeah, again, this is where we get, I guess, that drawbridge between the metaphysical and the physical community, where words are going to be different, the aim is going to be different, and the experience is going to be interpreted differently, because people that are rooted in traditional worldviews are going to use more of a sensory motor, more of a kind of a literal way to define even something as simple as meditation. They're going to use it as, oh, it's relaxation. They're going to talk about muscles. They're going to talk about physiology, things that you could stick a fork in. And then mm-hmm. the metaphysical community is going to take it much more on a figurative level and a metaphorical level, and they're going to take things more abstractly, which, even though they're having the same basic experience, again, the filters are different. So
yeah,
when you get them in the room together, especially within the same person, they might have, you know, two different modes for two different things that they're considering.
Mm-hmm.
And I always find people get almost to the point where they get nihilistic about it, where they get to the point where you get into that the crux of the mysteries and all that, and they just throw up their arms and they say, that's as far as I can go, this is too frustrating. And I can't, because it's like, it's not defined. No one told me what to think here. No one gave me any instructions.
Exactly.
And then, and then this is what you guys are getting into.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. First of all, with all of what we're talking about, I want to stress the point that nobody is doing it wrong. Nobody. There is no wrong and right here. Everyone is on their own specific evolutionary path. And with that place where they go, oh my gosh, I'm so frustrated and confused. Wow, this doesn't make any sense. So maybe I'll run for the hills. Even with that, that is a place in their being that is driving them to protect and deflect, and perhaps, and that's just part of their evolutionary process. There are a lot of people, however, feel that torque of confusion and frustration and say, wow, I can really feel this. Something about it feels juicy, and I want to know more. I want to go deeper into this confusion and find out what's there. That is where Samuel and I and many of our teachers in the Waking Down and Mutuality work, all of our teachers actually, assist individuals to go into their own specific, unique discovery of those difficult zones. We like to talk about embodiment of the difficulties, green lighting the places within your being that are difficult to look at, and that we're also very skilled at transcending from. Here, this is we're here on a planet. We're here in relationship. We're in a body. It's very precious. We're divinely human beings in relationship, and so that connection, that place of being with individuals, assists this place of holding, deep listening, and in some cases, very, very deep healing of the confusion.
Yeah, and I'll add to that, Mark, that the approach that we take is one that not only doesn't require belief systems and dogma and so forth, having an idea about how it is and being able to subscribe to that, but it specifically welcomes, actually requires people to be open to their doubt and their skepticism, to kick the tires of everything we're presenting and also their own beliefs and so forth, the ideas that they've tended to assume are true. And what makes that possible, in a way that we're very blessed to have seen great results with a lot of people, is that we bring to bear what we call a transmission, or in other words, an imparting of the energetic and conscious awareness that we've been able to move into and become stabilized in, that is holding or understanding our nature as simultaneously divine and human, or transcendent and limited, but not merely as an idea. It's become a living realization something that in some ways you can't even really describe, like the Buddha said when people would ask him, well, what is this enlightenment you're talking about? Mm-hmm. It can't be really described in a way that is sufficient because it's not comprehensible merely through logic any more than it's merely comprehensible through emotions or sensations. But it is a holistic, total reality that can be shared or imparted, radiated, transmitted. None of those words really do justice. But there is an ancient tradition that we're building on where this has happened from teachers to students, masters to disciples, whatever words you want to use. Our approach to it is very democratic, and we feel right on the edge of 21st century mutuality and sharing and participatory interactivity. And it winds up, when people become sympathetic to this energetic, this bio force, bio spiritual force, whatever you want to call it, and find themselves beginning to sense that changes are opening up, that's when the process that we're describing can become very effective for people. And it tends then to carry mind and emotions and sensations along with it and really begins to show itself to people as something that's, it's theirs. You know, it's not like they're imposing an outside external system on themselves. Linda likes to say this thing isn't a cookie cutter process. Your own version of it awakens, and as that starts to happen, it becomes very exciting and compelling for people.
Well, I kind of tend to liken it to as we physically learn how to walk. You know, everyone gets on their 2 feet eventually and figures out how to locomote and be ambulatory. But everyone has a slightly different gait. Everyone has a slightly different way of moving. Yet we're all walking. So eventually, on a collective level, you know, we're pedestrians moving along. But we might have a signature way that we do that. And in the learning process of learning how to walk, no two people do it the same way. So it's the same process you're talking about as we learn to get our spiritual legs. And I'm just looking online here before the show, and this is one of those eureka moments. I always feel like, I don't know if I'm the Indian or here comes Columbus again, but research shows the human body literally glows, emitting a visible light of extremely small qualities and levels that rise and fall throughout the day. I mean, they discovered that we emit light. Mm-hmm. They did a study on this, and the body glow, as they call it, it rises and falls throughout the day and suggests that there's a emission that's related to our body clocks and our metabolic rhythms, and mm-hmm. Oh my God, this is like a big deal.
And again,
being the Indian, being the one that was there before, having the indigenous sort of the innate awareness of it from my own personal experience, then when you see science come along and validate this, now for how many years have you been going to trade shows and expos and they have the Carilion photographer in the corner, you know, usually from Sedona or some spiritual place, yeah. some Taos or from, Santa Fe, and they look at the aura. This is, like I said, this is where the technology, the science, the culture, and the personal experience are all overlapping. And you get the hands on the elephant interpretation of it. Wherever you're coming from is what you're gonna. That's what you're gonna walk away with it from. So, the process of heart gazing, just to give people an idea, you've already done the. If you've ever had an experience with someone where you think you knew them before or something like that in conversation, you have that kind of. I feel like I kind of resonate with this person, even though you're not consciously going through the process of heart gazing, as I understand it. And we'll get into the nuances of it in a sec here. There's a certain amount of, and this is getting all sciencey again, it's called limbic resonance or dyadic communication that mother-child has. Sometimes you see it with teacher-student. You definitely see it with peer groups and definitely intimate pair bonding, things like that, where you literally have a resonance between the two people that can be measured by all these funky little things. And heart gazing just takes it to a level of making it much more of a metabolic sort of a, I don't want to say guided meditation, but It has a physical departure point and a metaphysical arrival point. So why don't you guys give us an overview of how, if someone just listening the first time and they heard us say heart gazing a couple times, what would be the process if they wanted to do a quick version of this while they're listening along?
Well, thank you for asking. It's so exciting. I love talking about this process because on some level it is so simple, and yet it's immensely deep and very traditional from, you know, other traditions eons ago. So basically how we came up with the concept or the feeling sense of doing heart-gazing offerings is, we were, both Samuel and I were feeling like we wanted to reach more people, and it didn't really have to be spiritual seekers looking for enlightenment or embodied conscious awakening. It's really, this process can reach anyone in their religious belief system, their spiritual path, wherever they are, wherever they're moving in the world. And so basically what we do when we go to an event of heart gazing, so we have a brief introductory period. We talk to the group, and then we set chairs up in front of Samuel and I, and we literally just sit and look into the person's eyes for, you know, 30 seconds, a minute. Samuel does very uninvasive touch, you know, on the throat, at the top of the head, the crown chakra. Touches the feet, which is a very honoring traditional move that devotees would do to their guru. Well, Samuel does it to the participant sitting in front of him. And then simultaneously, as I'm gazing with the participant, I just hold the palms of their hands, and we just gaze into each other's eyes. There's no one thing that you should be doing while we're doing the gazing. It's really just a deep heart meeting, being to being. We're not trying to manipulate energies or read your mind or move things or heal any particular thing unless that's requested, and then we could maybe do a little focusing on that. But it's really just a being to being, meeting to meeting. In that encounter, since Samuel and I have been awakened teachers of the processes that we've done for many years, there is a form of transmission of being that is an activating force for individuals. Some people are very sensitive to it, others not quite so. And so that's okay. Again, nobody's doing anything wrong. It's really just a way for us to hold the space, be with individuals with the intention, if there's any intention, to just support and love and hold from the heart. And we've been doing this now across the country, and it's just been amazing, Mark, to encounter the beautiful beings in front of you as you gaze with them. While Samuel and I are gazing with these individuals for a minute or so, we have the group do mutual gazing. So we pair people off, and then I'll do some toning to end the 30 seconds or a minute. Samuel might blow on his flute. We kind of go back and forth. And then everybody switches to a new person, and people kind of come around and sit with us. So the whole room gets to encounter each individual in these gazing moments, again, just holding the space for being with each other and supporting. And it's really quite wonderful. It can actually activate a lot of tears for me. I'm very sensitive to individuals, and my heart just bursts open so often when I'm sitting in front of these incredible beings. I feel very connected to them. And I hear quite often from others, you know, doing the mutual gazing, they feel lots of different things moving. Thoughts may arise and concerns and questions, but that's okay too. That's part of being human.
I just wanted to jump in a second here because I find this to be remarkable that you get people to be open enough to do this, because in my work, just getting, say, the average walking around, not really spiritually jazzed up person to look at themselves in the mirror. And if I ask them the question, are you looking at the reflection or is your reflection looking at you? And then I think about two steps away, because that's when their brain goes, what do you mean? this happens in every conversation you have with every other human being. That's the self, other, yin and yang, a self and other. And what you're getting to, is a point of union between you and the other person, where there is no boundary anymore. That's why you're saying you're not looking at them, you're seeing them, you're allowing them to come into your world and you're sharing. So, Sanya, talk about how you kind of, you know, cobbled together this process from where did it start? Did it start from doing more meditation work? Did it start from doing more of the spiritual practices where you'd be dealing with energy transfer, things like that?
Well, thank you for asking. That's, in fact, exactly what I was going to mention next. Yeah, I spent my whole adult life from the age of 20 was pretty much given over to a spiritual quest for enlightenment, awakening, and that led me to both Western and Eastern teachers and teachings, and that was where I became over that couple of decades and up until my early 40s, very accustomed to and schooled in these traditions where men and women who had come into great stages of spiritual awakening or realization or awareness are able not only to talk about it and give people practices, but to transmit that condition to others and help activate these kinds of changes. And I love the way you describe that. I think it's part of the wonderful wedding of science and spirituality that we have language and documentation from neuroscience and so forth, and can talk about things like limbic resonance along with more traditional spiritual concepts and kinds of understanding. So what happened, Mark, was that in the early 1990s, my own spiritual process reached a kind of crystallization where this quality of the heart, all capital letters, became very clear to me that this was something I was living now, and quickly my friends started saying to me, look, you know, this is affecting me too, what you're going through. And this led to the desire to really see how many people we could share this with and train others to become transmitters themselves. And though our work is not, you know, hugely well known, like some of the people you mentioned earlier, we're having wonderful results. Well, then more recently, Linda and I were, as she mentioned, very passionate about finding ways to make this kind of connection with more people and not assume that everybody who comes into it wants to go through an intense transformational kind of process that might or might not really dramatically change their lives. And you know, spirituality has that potential.
It messes people's lives up to the point where they don't want to go anymore because it's too painful. You're right.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not their time to grow in those ways. They have other ways of growth and development that are going on. So what we saw was that we could use this traditional technique that spiritual adepts have used in many different cultures. And I love this is something that we say to groups also. This is not all that different from what a mother does with her infant, from what lovers do together, from what friends do together. When there is that trust, that safety that people sense, and we, in our introductory occasions, we make sure to, make it clear to people this is not an opportunity to work on somebody else's energy or try to read their mind and do all, just meet them, just come in contact with that mysterious other being. And yeah, that's what we came up with, was an approach where we took this, one of these traditional techniques. It's said in the Indian yoga traditions, for instance, that spiritual adepts can impart their awakened condition through such means as glance and touch and speech and mere presence and so on. So we call it heart gazing because there's a particular emphasis on making eye contact in this beautiful, gentle way that Linda was describing. But it's really a sharing that occurs on many levels, and especially when we're working with people who are interested in a more profound transformation. There's a whole variety of teaching methods and helpful means that we use.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing I find, again, this is one of those things, if you've been on the path, as it were, which people say all the time, you're on the path, I'm on the path, we're on the path, is that you'll pick up some of these, you know, tools, I'll call them, you know, if you're doing creative visualization or any of the internal processes, say, right? And then at a certain point, you're gonna do some group work. You're going to go to a chanting thing or a circle or a drumming circle or something like that. What you guys are doing is you're taking a lot of the window dressing away. And every day, and I sort of stress this in my work, you're going to, at some point, have a conversation, usually with other people, sometimes with yourself too. And what you're saying at that moment, there's kind of a moment of truth there. Where are you going to cooperate or are you going to go into conflict? You know, it's like every day that sort of a possibility exists, and you're making it a social experience. When you make the spiritual realm more socially accessible, so it isn't something that only the people that are sitting and meditating in the corner can do, or only the people that are going to the drumming circle can do. Everyone can do this. It's very inclusive, and it's certain that, again, that's another disarming element. Just like starting from the heart rather than starting from the head, and making it a belief that you have to adopt rather than an experience you can share. So all of those kind of components, those ingredients, that's what attracted me to getting you on the show, is that most people are out there. They're just I get a little bit to the point where I just want to simplify down to the nub, because I dealing with people, especially here on the East Coast, not so much you guys out there. You guys have ways of relaxing. Right here, we love the tension. We just drink it in. And there's a practice out here you guys have probably stumbled across it called Avatar. And they're very, very, shishi about what they do. But they do have this sort of acceptance practice that they do where it's called Just Like Me. And so you meet somebody that's maybe ticking you off, and you go, just like me, this person is attempting to live their life as successfully as possible. They never need to be loved. They've gone through loss. All the common ground you could possibly summon up when someone's coming into you with conflict. And it dilutes the polarization. It sort of drops the guard, as it were. And it allows you to see that person separate from their behavior and separate from what you're going to characterize that behavior as, good, bad, or indifferent. And what you guys are doing with heart gazing is you're using the physical template of the body, and especially the focus of the eyes. And I don't know, is it more of a soft focus on the other person, or are you looking directly into their eyes?
No, you're looking directly into their eyes. You're being right there with them. It's like you're meeting halfway in between, but you're really reaching to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we talk about an imaging practice in this work when you're doing somatic profiling to see what type of image that person's giving off, and that is a four-second window that the brain uses to assess if that person is stranger, friend, foe, you know, relative, kind of like, how do I recognize this person in front of me? What do I see here? And I've had, you know, parents do this with their children, where if that person in front of you was not your son or daughter, what would you see? And what kind of image? Does the energy travel from you to them to you, back and forth, or nowhere? And you're trying to go for the nowhere. You're trying to go for the still point, which is the exosomatic vantage point, which makes everything basically structurally stable. It puts you into a crystallization experience where, you, again, not being able to distinguish self from other anymore, because there's no more label. There's just this leverage of energy that becomes like a shared energy. Like you say, you lose the you and me and you get to we.
Yeah.
And when you're in that we bubble, at that point, you're transcending the physical realm. And you feel just like, you know, I hate to say it, cells do that to become tissues. Tissues do that to become organs. Organs to systems, and then into an organism, and then individuals, and then all the way up to the cosmos. So this little Russian doll trick that you guys are doing with the eyes, do you find that as people practice this? And
I just got to interrupt you. That was really good.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. We'll quote you.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Little belief. Footnote me there. Do you find that, and again, I've taught some people this, especially dealing with the right eye and the left eye. When you look at somebody left eye to left eye, the nervous system is oriented to join, go horizontal, and bond. And when you go right eye to right eye, it's more oriented to go vertical and individuate like a blade of grass. So because you're using both eyes and fusing at the same time, you're creating a diagonal that is going to either point the two people more up into a sort of a transcendentary or kind of an elevated state, or down and root them. So either way, they're going to feel different. They're going to feel a kind of a cosmic disorientation instead of a terrestrial one. And I just, you know, it's like, because if on a given day, if someone's staring at you like that for more than 7 seconds, you're either going to make love to them or you're going to fight them, you know.
I love that.
You know, so something's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the potential is. It's like people get nervous, and again, I've dealt with people that have all kinds of social, quibbles about this, and just dealing with the mirror. So sometimes, you have them practice with like a magazine article or something like that. You know, just take the people that pose for a living, you know, celebrities, people like that. And you could see the way their eyes are different. If you cover one eye might look more receptive, one eye might look more judgmental. And it's that 4 second little math that your brain's doing to say, this person my friend, this person my enemy. And all of those dichotomies kind of go away when you're not coming from the me to them perspective. You're coming from a we. And then it's pouring into me and it's pouring into you, and you're starting in the middle and coming back and starting in the middle and going forward. So do you find people that have, say, visual problems or have emotional imbalances or have any number of ailments that would impair their ability to do this as a physical process, do you find that they have resistance to it, or do you find they have an aversion to it, or can you get them through the loop?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you. First of all, the vulnerability that you were touching on, Mark, is just huge. I mean, it isn't something that we humans walk around doing every day, staring at people, right?
Right.
I love your thing of make love or fight somebody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It opens up a sense of insecurity sometimes when you encounter another person's gaze. But with the intention, the heartfelt intention of just meeting that person no matter where they are, and being able to verbalize that prior to the actual event, you know, excuse me about that, the motorcycle.
No.
You know, connecting with that person on that deep, deep level kind of breaks away in some ways the guards. Now, individuals who have bad eyesight, I'm very nearsighted, so sometimes if I'm not so close to the person, I have to wear my glasses or my contacts in order to actually see their eyes very clearly. It doesn't impede on the transmission of being, although for me, I feel I really want to see them clearly, so that's how I deal with it. Others, similarly, as far as emotional stresses or places where people really feel unsafe, we say to them, please trust your boundaries. If you need to not do this, if this is where you're really, really feeling scared and not prepared, then don't do the practice. We don't force anything on anyone. But we do try to create an atmosphere of safety and an atmosphere of, as you're saying, this connectedness to one another, this mutuality that enables people to go deeply with each other.
Yeah, and again, Daniel, this is more for you. As you develop this practice, I deal a lot with people that have issues with interpersonal distance, whether they need people to be very close to them or they can't get people within 5 feet of them. And this is a neurological thing as well. You get, say, I don't know if you're familiar with the family constellations work or, you know, some of these other practices that deal with this kind of a group interaction thing.
Yeah.
Do you ever get the one wing nut who just cannot get with the rest of the group? And it's just like the entire time of the workshop, you've got to deal with this one person who just doesn't want that person near them or doesn't want or can't have a window open. Because I always find the more general you make it, the more generic you make it, the more open you make it, the more people that are polarizers will take that little rope you give them and run to, you know, San Diego with it, and say, I'm gonna balloon animal this thing until I feel safe. And it's not because they are trying to crash the entire seminar. It's because
right.
they are wired in a way
That's right.
that doesn't allow them to share their energy this way. So how do you
Thank
clue
you.
How people in and rein them in with that?
Well, yeah, that happens from time to time. Happily, we haven't experienced too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
We try to set things up in such a way that the structure of the event is itself a kind of container that would tend to restrain that kind of expression. And, you know, we have a lot of compassion for people, so we just work with them as sensitively as we can to help them be present in the event in a way that doesn't intrude on other people's opportunity and what they're there for. And likewise with, conceivably, what if someone wants to come and participate and they're blind? Or have other impairments. Well, because this sharing is of, in some ways, what we could call more than just love and a sense of connectedness, it's also the feeling of being, the most fundamentally positive sense of our existence itself and our being here together as humans. Most people will be able to find a way to benefit and will be able to find a way to communicate to help them become receptive to this transmission. So it can be done. And, a lot of people, to go back to the wingnut description there, a lot of people wander around in spiritual circles as well as psychological circles who actually are developmentally impaired, and they have to be helped to find better resources for themselves. And sometimes that's a sticky bit of business, but usually it can be conducted in a compassionate and honoring way. They're inferior; they're just in a different stage of development.
Yeah, have you guys encountered that? I mean, I don't know if you've dealt with people that, you know, are coming out of traumatic circumstances, you know, whether it's a Katrina situation or, you know, an earthquake or, and very similar to EMDR and some of the other, I'm just going to call them eye-based modalities like this, that deal with more getting people into a rhythm with it, that they feel connected again. Some of the older traditions like Reiki do the same thing, but this particular approach is direct because you want people's full attention. And when you're dealing with someone who's been traumatized or is walking around with a post-traumatic stress pattern, they have a very hard time focusing their eyes on another person because maybe they've been abused, maybe they've been raped, maybe they've been beaten, you know, all kinds of, any number of things traveling around in their little somas there. So do you make those issues, do you kind of give a disclaimer? Say, look, if this happened to you and you're not here to bear your soul. You are here to share your soul, but not bear it. Do you give people sort of an out to say, if at any point in the interaction, if you feel, you know, it's too much heat coming at you, this is too much, you just disengage eye contact and we'll give you a break. And it's almost like learning how to ride a bike, or is it everybody gets into the guppy pool and learns the basic swimming lessons and goes on to the intermediate and then into the deep water?
No, that's really a good point. I kind of touched on it a little bit ago that people need to set healthy boundaries. And if they are feeling that it's too much, then really trust the level of what any individual can take. And that can be linking to some severe abuse or even just feeling ill that day, you know, just not on and feeling very sensitive in the body and not feeling particularly receptive to gazing with individuals. We encourage people to really feel what is appropriate for them at each and every moment along the way, and for the other participants to not take it so personally if one has to disengage. It's important for people to hear that up front and to develop that level of trust within the room, the context of the whole room, and with Samuel and I, in order to maybe open up a little bit at a time so we encourage them to find a rhythm with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to go a little further with that, Mark, excuse me, heart gazing as an offering, as something that Linda and I do, is a relatively new expression of our work, but we've been developing a more intensive healing and transformational and awakening process with a wonderful group of dedicated people who initially, many of them were my students, and now they've become colleagues, and the work is growing, and we call it Waking Down in Mutuality, which partakes, I think you can hear in the title, of many of these aspects of growth and transformation. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because we've made quite an exploratory journey of finding out how we can work with people who are significantly traumatized, have what we call significant broken zones, places in their psychological and emotional structure and their spiritual structure where they're wounded, frozen, numb, shattered. And we've discovered that by creating really a kind of a cultural process or a sacred container of workshops and events and relationships that have the same kind of impact as what we've been describing with respect to heart gazing itself, that create that safety and that give people more room and we like to say help them green light the parts of themselves that feel the most unspiritual and dangerous and scary. We've seen great healing and transformation occur. So, you know, there's part of this heart gazing process that's simple and can be gotten into, you know, if people come and meet us on our travels. We have a lot of traveling we're doing these days in what we call our Take Heart Tour. Again, that word heart with capital letters. But also we have online offerings that people can get into and a whole community network of people who have become similarly sensitized and more attuned. And, you know, so there are options for people who have post-traumatic stress and other kinds of severe things that they're dealing with, and we've seen some wonderful developments with that.
Yeah, I always think in terms of special needs families. I mentioned the Family Constellations work before. And even in my world, you know, dealing with just something as simple as asthma, where the kid is always separate. He can't play gym. He can't go to birthday parties. You know, he can't do soccer and stuff like that. So the kid's always feeling separate. If the family takes on the practice of doing something as simple as doing breath work when they sit down to have a meal, when they get in the car to go travel as a group, the kid feels like, well, this is a practice that my family does. We all do breath work, and he doesn't feel like the asthmatic, whereas, you know, in traditional approaches, in mainstream anyway, it always seems to be to find the weakness in the individual, find the flaw, and then try to cover up that weakness in any number of interventions. Where you're saying the empowerment side of this is that because this transmission is going on, whether we're aware of it or not, whether we have a map for it or not, it's more of a tuning in than a sort of a, I hate to say the word, hazing. That seems to go on in a lot of the spiritual practices that I see where they, unless you believe this, like law of attraction, for a perfect example, I have a lot of issues with the law of attraction as an isolated, you know, there's about 15 hermetic principles. They just took one that was really easy to sell and just sit and stare at the wall and everything comes to you. And if you didn't accept it, if you didn't, you know, then there was something wrong with you or you weren't doing it enough. And what you're saying here is that as people get into their own rhythm with this and get into their own sort of like idiosyncratic way of applying the basics, the complicated end of it or the deep end of it or the more advanced end of it comes to them rather than them going to it.
That's very true. And we, the real essential foundation of our whole thing is a deep recognition that culturally humanity has been governed. In culture and prior to that in consciousness, we've been governed by what we could call a spirit-matter split. Mm-hmm. And so those on the matter side, like you mentioned earlier, tend to not even acknowledge that anything spiritual is real. Those on the spirit side assume that the material side is a handmaiden or the enemy of our spiritual reality. And part of what this has, in practical terms, tended to produce in people that gets reproduced in a lot of these systems is what we perceive as a kind of violence. People are seeking something that they think they don't have or don't have access to, and in order to get to it, they're taught and conditioned to fight against those parts of themselves that appear to be the hindrances. And so, yeah, I love that that description you just gave. It's not a kind of a hazing and a self-hazing process and getting better and better at the internal fight or war, but it is this natural, organic opening that, like Linda was saying, we never rush people into things. We don't force it. Doesn't mean that we can't back somebody off if they're getting obnoxious or taking over the space. I mean, you know, it's not just everybody nicey-nicey,
yeah.
But there is a fundamental...
let's all be spiritual, right?
Yeah, let's all be spiritual, et cetera.
Gotta be positive. We can't,
right, yeah, that whole thing. I mean, we find that there's actually an implicit negative in that one entrepreneurial teacher called it militant positive thinking,
mm-hmm.
Where you've just got to be positive all the time.
Yeah, it's such a hijacking of the the nectar of these practices that it makes people more rigid as a result, and actually more judgmental and less inclined to be compassionate because they're too busy judging everybody as being, you know, some ridiculous standard. And, you know, if I took a hammer at my thumb, I'm going to scream. I might even curse. And if in some of these traditions, it makes you almost to the point where you're dirty for having any human, you know, quality that might not be on the most, you know, aesthetic standard, and that's why to me these things dry up and go away pretty quick, and I get a little frustrated with it, and that's why I regularly pound the secret on the show when someone brings it up, or law of attraction, just to kind of keep them in their corner. But I guess, you know, the remaining moments here, I want to get into a little Ken Wilber with you guys. Now, eventually, if you're in the bookstore long enough, and you've gone from the self-help section to the psychology section, maybe to the neuroscience section, maybe over to the fiction side, eventually you're going to bump into Ken Wilber because he's got about 30 books out there on every shelf, you know, pretty much. He's covered every shelf at this point. And a couple of years ago he wrote a book called Integral Spirituality that attempted to take his basic, I think it's Wilber 5.0 map, to a level where he can embrace all the spiritual traditions with this acronym called AQUIL. Now, people listen to the show might have heard me mention it once in a while, but AQUIL has to do with a fundamental or what he calls a holonic view, not holistic, holonic view of the world that unfolds into four distinct quadrants, as he calls it, that will encompass every culture, you know, all of it, because he's a map guy. And you guys have been dealing with this terrain, as we've been talking for the last hour. And I guess you guys contributed to the book or somehow interacted with them out there in Colorado as they were putting it together. Explain how you guys even crossed paths first.
Well, I met Ken when I was a member of a spiritual community that he had a kind of a friendly association with back in the... I guess mostly in the 80s and 90s. And then as I got into my own work, he very kindly acknowledged the authenticity of what I was doing. And Linda and he and I became more personally friendly in the early years of this decade. And we were invited by Ken to be founding members of his Integral Institute, and then he created this other group called the Integral Spiritual Center that's going through some morphing and changes now, and we've been part of that from the beginning. And we're great lovers of Ken Wilber and his work and his contribution, which doesn't mean that we subscribe to everything he says or view that particular map as being absolute. But then if you read him closely, he says, you know, he's well aware that it's just another map also, but a very extraordinary one.
Oh, he likes his map, believe me. I've crossed his path many times, and he did a lot, it's a pretty map. He did a good job.
And he
regularly embraces the people that do spiral dynamics. And their map, and he's now merged those two. And again, I go back to the somatic root of it. He's an exo. He has to externalize it because he has no place to put it inside, because that's not the way he's wired. So the map becomes the technology, becomes the navigation, becomes like I talked about at the top of the show, it becomes the instructions, it becomes the way to kind of guide yourself through what would normally be a very murky and sort of disorienting experience. He gives you a map and says, okay, from this vantage point it's this, from this vantage point it's that, and he goes into his interobjective, intersubjective, all that stuff. And you guys, it's like I said, bringing you back to flesh, bone, and breath, where it can actually kind of live in the world without having to go through all the filters, is what I'm feeling that heart gazing is more akin to, and it's more of a knee-to-knee, you know, sort of soul-to-soul kind of a conversation than it is more brain-to-brain, map-to-map, head-to-head, sort of a prove-it-to-me kind of a thing that I see so often in some of these things where they have to prove that there's a, and it happens in somatics too, well, prove that this helps somebody, prove that this is having an impact on, you know, on someone with cancer, or so, or prove this is going to help somebody get over their loss of their spouse. And it's as if the assumption is that the mainstream has something behind the corner that they haven't showed you yet that has proof. So it's like, it seems like the metaphysical community is always on the hot seat to validate itself to the physical side of the coin, when in fact the other direction has never been tested or held to that standard at all. And that's why I feel like that to me is where something like what you're doing, because you've made it social, because you made it more about a, as you call it, a mutuality. When I think about the key benefit, people go into these workshops and they're usually coming into it not because life is going great. They're going in because life has reached a crossroads and they are lost and they are looking for the information station to start over again. And some of them have gone along the cafeteria, and this is just the next stop on the train, and you can tell them when they sign up. They've been through it. They've got their merit badge, been around the world. You know, I've been to the pyramids. I've been over here. I've been to this vortex. And then you get the ones that are the drag-alongs that came because their friend took them. And then you get the ones that are really going there with sort of a curiosity that you might have had when the first time you were meditating and got to that realm, wow, I really did get out there. Or I really did have this astral projection, or whatever the process was, that exhilarating, that sort of exciting side of it. And what I'm getting out of what you're saying to me here is that the tangible immediacy of having someone look at you and not judge you, not label you, not see you as different, not see you as separate, not see you as foreign or outside or anything else, is so rare in regular life experience. That in and of itself is on the front of the brochure, is that you will be seen and you will be felt and you will be received as you've never been before, period, end all stop. You got to come to this just for that. Even if you never did anything else with this work, to have that experience disrupts the noise that is their regular life. So would you say that that's the hook?
That is beautiful. You do not have to perfect the body-mind in order to be the good practitioner.
Uh-huh.
Or be the spiritual one, or be the good person. You do not have to perfect it. That's what you're saying.
And also, I think we literally use language right lifting off what you just said. We we refer to this heart transmission as primal nutrition for the whole being.
Indeed.
Uh-huh.
And it's a primal nutrition that comes from a condition in us for which we're very, very grateful, feel very blessed, that is in a fundamental way healed from this spirit-matter split. So it tends to activate that same kind of healing in others. And I like to say that the transmission is, yes, in some way it's coming from someone who's outside you, but it's touching that, or I like to say it turns up the gas on the pilot light, the flame in your own heart of hearts. And that's actually bio-spiritual, not merely metaphorical and poetic. And so you're exactly right in terms of how we almost feel like this work is in some ways a kind of an antidote, or let's say a complement is a better way to put it, to the more cerebral and conceptual pursuits and developments and to the whole deluge of information that everybody is struggling to integrate in their lives. So that's why we put heart gazing out front. And I don't know, are we coming to the end here? Should we mention a website?
Yeah, well, I actually got to get to this one issue that I always do towards the end.
Okay.
Some people tend to fast forward to this because this is the exciting part for them. we've gone through a lot of the, you know, the normal things that we got through. We want to get to the number one misconception about your work, that if someone just stumbled upon it as a result of listening to the show and they get curious, they flip over to your site, which is SamuelandLinda.com is the main site, or you can just go to the right to heartgazing.com and read about that and get the course online, all that stuff. What is the number one misconception about your work you want to clear up for the listener right here and now so that they don't walk away from this confused or you know, with some type of fog in their head about what exactly it is they're getting involved with?
Shall I, Linda, or do you want to take this one?
Well, why don't you start?
Okay. We may have three different number one misconceptions. That's
okay.
Part of the perks of having a team here.
Yes.
Well, I would say one very, very high up there on the list, and it's a great question. We'll contemplate it some more. But one that I deal with a lot is the notion that it's just all wishy-washy, touchy-feely, woo-woo, that there's no real depth to it, that it, you know, it doesn't have any intellectual depth or real profound context to it. And it does. Mm-hmm. Even though the essence is very simple, very human and humane, and goes right for the, you know, what's in the rib cage here, this is a very fully developed, not only process of transformation, but also understanding, and has a great potential to be met on many levels, including the intellectual. So that's one side of it for me.
Okay.
Yeah, I think also when people encounter it and hear the description, one of their reactions will say is, well, what's the practice? What's the actual discipline? What are we actually doing? Well, the practice and the discipline, if you want to even call it that, is the gazing itself. It's not even really about a formal kind of cookie cutter, again, doing that everyone has to plug into. It's really just being to being. And that's where the simplicity comes in and the beauty of the simplicity, because that will also help individuals relax into it more, I think.
Yeah, and on those lines, if people go to heartgazing.com, which is really the best place to go in terms of getting your feet in the water with us at this point, we have a four-session free course there, audio course, as well as photographs that people can begin doing this gazing with us just through the photographs. And it's interesting because we've heard many people say, you know, I thought, well, that's kind of weird, or, you know, how can that possibly work? Well, try it out. It can. And there's also, Mark, speaking of East Coast, which, by the way, I came from New York myself.
Okay.
But one of our friends in our work, Mark Taylor, lives in Manhattan, and he wrote of his own accord. He wrote a great essay that he called "The Golden Rules of Gazing," and people really enjoy it. It's both very respectful and honoring, and also irreverent and just fun. I mean, he has one thing in there, a list of the thoughts and feelings that can come up inside you while you're gazing, including things like how long is this going to last, and
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, actually, if people are...
And can I scratch my nose?
Right.
Yeah, oh yeah, this is the self-conscious social part of it that makes it kind of, like I said, it makes it real.
Uh-huh.
We have it up there in the description on the previous, so anyone that missed it, the link is there in the description. You can click over to it there, and if you're too lazy to do that, because people do that, just email me here at nakedsoma@gmail.com. I'll shoot it over to you. It's a great little article. It does, like I said, it does make this thing more accessible and approachable, which is what the whole point of it is. And you guys have been a joy to have on the show. We went a little overtime, but I think we covered pretty much stem to stern on it. And I thank you guys for really bringing a lot to the table tonight for people to think about and listen back and learn about something that they probably won't see on an infomercial at 2:00 in the morning, telling them that they're going to, you know, inherit internet millions if they subscribe right now while the operators are standing by. So the evolution will not be televised, as they say.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. We also want to quickly just mention that heart gazing is just one facet of the work that Samuel and I do.
Mm-hmm.
And in our business, our work called The Whole Heart Way, we have many, many more advanced courses, online courses, workshops that we offer around the country. So we'd really love the listeners to stay plugged in,
mm-hmm.
check out the beginnings of us and the more advanced courses. And we are just so wholeheartedly welcoming anyone to experience us if and when we're in your town or even online. So
well, there's your infomercial right there, guys. So
yeah, there you go.
We got it in without fuss or muss. We didn't sell a vacuum cleaner or anything else.
Well, Mark, I want to take one extra half a minute and just thank you for really bringing such a wonderful orientation and so much really helpful perspective to the conversation. I mean, we're gonna strongly recommend that people in our work listen to this to get your take on it. So it's really great talking with you.
I'm glad I could contribute to it. Hopefully, you know, someone will listen to this on their way to or from one of your workshops and take it to the next person that needs to hear it, because I think you got a wonderful message, and I'm happy to help spread it out here on the Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you so much, Mark. This has been great. It's been a lot of fun. Really appreciate you.
All right, guys. Looking forward to meeting you down the path. Thanks for joining us tonight, and have a good rest of the summer.
Yes.
You too.
Too. Bye now.
Okay. Take care, guys.
Take care.
All right. There they go. I think. Something about this... The switchboard always makes me nervous. Doesn't seem to. Well, there goes the entire switchboard. I don't know what just happened. Oh, okay, there they go. So yeah, we covered some bases tonight. Like I said, we had to get through the fog of my Mets and their cantankerous assistant general manager, who probably needs to do a little heart gazing. Might be doing that in the unemployment line. You know.
You filthy criminals.
And that's to Obama and the Congress as they attempt to define health and well-being out there in the landscape. But we're not going there tonight. No, we're going to go to the boss himself, as it were, as we close out the show. Oh, look, I almost got it right to the spot. Hang on a second, Bruce. You believe this? Come on. The DJ, I'm not. So anyway, I'm gonna play a little Bruce here for you first as we wind down.
Carrie's blues is a winner. Carrie's heart gambles this dream. Carrie's lost soul, I said this train. Carrie's broken hearted, this train. These are sweet souls departed.
I want to get that in there. If you're a regular reader of my wavelengths, which you can subscribe to, if you get a hold of me here at nakedsummer@gmail.com. It's sort of the somatic lullaby I try to impart on the air every week, and we get a lot of weirdness out here. And next week we will be going to the musical side of the Soma as the lovely and talented band Entrain, literally the band's called Entrain, joins us to talk about their work and their travels and had a little summer night off. We had the McCartney come through City Field this week. Height of the summer, you know, play a little music, relax a little bit, and take it to the next level here on Summertime. You know, why not? So, for everybody out there listening, everybody out there not listening, and everybody out there trying not to listen, I know you're out there. This is Dr. Mark saying travel light, and we will see you next week. Spiral on, my sapiens. Spiral on. Say that.